Well, good morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, and this is the Offbeat Oregon History Podcast, which every weekday brings you another story from the archives of the Offbeat Oregon History syndicated newspaper column. A new column gets added to the archives every Friday, you know, and today's Friday, so this story is brand new. Well, sort of. You know, the newspapers get these columns exclusively for 2 months, so I can't post them on offbeatoregon.com until those 2 months have gone by. Well, for this story, they've just gone by. So it just went live on the website today, and I'm going to read it to you now. Thank you very much for loading me down and queuing me up, and I hope you enjoy this show. Today I'm going to tell you the story of Larry Sullivan's Portland Shanghaiing Syndicate, a dark cabal of boarding masters in the city of Portland. This is the second part of the two-part series about Larry Sullivan in Portland. The legendary boarding master sparked an international incident when he figured out how to shake the ship captains down, foiling their plans to stiff their sailors for the journey's wages and managing to keep most of the proceeds for himself. It did benefit the sailors a little bit, but that was kind of an ancillary benefit, at best. This particular article was written on January 6th, 2013. This is the first column of 2013, which is our sixth year. It's hard to believe. Of course, 2008 we just caught the tail end of, so technically it's more like 5 years. But actually, no, it's not 5 years. It's more like 4 years and a month. Good thing I'm not a math professor, huh? Okay, well, enough stalling. Let's get this story. Here we go. In the mid-1890s, ship captains and sailors' boarding house operators were like partners in crime, both of them busily and happily swindling sailors out of what little money they had and were owed. But in the mid-1890s, something happened to upset this cozy arrangement. One particular boarding master in one particular West Coast city figured out how to double-cross his co-conspirators, and suddenly the ship captains were left out in the cold. To explain how this was pulled off, I'm going to start by explaining how the scam had been working up until boarding house operator and Shanghai artist Larry Sullivan and his business partners turned the program on its ear. You see, when a ship came into port, representatives from the local boarding houses, they called them runners, would go out and meet it. They'd break the law by rowing out and climbing up on the ship before it had even tied up at the pier, and then they'd hand out cigars and bottles to the sailors and invite them all to a welcoming party at the boarding house. Naturally, most of the lads didn't need much persuading. After all, they'd been at sea for weeks, so over the side they would go. The captain, in the old days, would watch them go and smile to himself. He knew that as long as the men were ashore, he didn't have to feed them or pay them wages. He also knew that most of them would not be around when it came time to ship out, and that meant that he would be able to keep all the wages that were owed to them. That's because it was standard procedure in many nations' ships, especially British ones, and most of the ships were British at this time, to not pay the sailors until the cruise was over. This was to discourage them from deserting along the way, and also to try to encourage the money to stay in the local British economy rather than be spread out all over the world. Well, when the men did desert, the captain got to keep all the money they'd earned for the entire voyage up to that point. So under the old system, when it came time to sail, the sailors who couldn't be found would be replaced with new hires supplied by the same boarding house owners who had lured the old ones away. The boarding house bills would be paid with an advance against the new sailors' wages, and the skipper would pony up a bonus, popularly called blood money, as the price of the boarding house operator's services in making the sailor available. Well, this system was something of a quasi-criminal conspiracy to rob and enslave, effectively, the sailors, and it made both parties rich. Actually, there's three parties to this transaction, and I'm talking about two of them that were made rich. The sailors certainly did not get rich. But the skipper got to keep all the deserters' pay, which could add up to thousands of dollars on an entire ship's load of deserting sailors. The boarding house operator got to charge virtually whatever he wanted for room and board, and then also collect a big blood money bonus to boot. What Larry figured out was that there was money to be made by double-crossing the captains, essentially robbing the other robbers, and he worked out an arrangement for how to do it. First, he disciplined the unruly Portland Shanghaiing scene into something like an informal cartel, a sort of diabolical labor union, with himself as the director. any local boarding house operator unwilling to join and play by the rules would find himself, as historian Barney Blaylock Riley puts it, in a great deal of physical discomfort, thanks to the bare-knuckle boxer's well-calloused fists. This would ensure that the captains had to deal with his cartel whether they wanted to or not. Then, he and the other boarding house men started coaching sailors to commit some minor offense that would land them in the police court. Petty theft, perhaps, or public drunkenness. Vagabondage, maybe? I guess it was called vagrancy. Anyway, Larry's friends in high places would arrange for the sailors to draw a little jail time for whatever they'd done, and then, when the time came for the ship to leave, the skipper would look for his men and find that they'd all been picked up on goofy, petty charges, all at more or less the same time, and had all just started serving 30-day jail sentences. Well then, unless he was willing to wait a whole month for them to get out of jail, the captain would have to hire a new crew. When he went to do that, he would find that the price was unusually steep, and he'd maybe shop around a little bit, but every crimp in town would be demanding the same price. Larry'd made sure that nobody undercut the cartel. But that was not where the real money was being made. The real money was the crew's wages. Wages the skippers had formerly been able to keep. The thing was, the skipper only got to keep it if the crew member had deserted and couldn't be found. If a crew member was ready, willing, and able to report for duty, but was legally prevented from doing so because he was locked up in the local hoosegow on trumped-up charges, the skipper did not get to keep those wages, because that sailor was not a deserter. He had to either stay in port until the sailor was released from custody, or leave his wages behind for him. So, not only did this unfortunate skipper have to pony up hundreds of dollars in blood money to hire a new crew, he had to pay out thousands of dollars in other people's money that he had been expecting to essentially embezzle. It was great for the sailors, though. Although Larry took a healthy cut of the cash as a fee for his services, the sailors were actually getting paid part or maybe even most of what was legitimately owed to them. Of course, the captains were furious and fought back as best they could, but they soon figured out that their bargaining position, not a strong one. Skippers who resisted soon found themselves entangled in a world of expensive and time-consuming problems, and every day their ships were delayed in port cost them hundreds of dollars in demurrage charges and opportunity costs. Demurrage charges are the daily charges that a ship incurs for occupying space in a port. One skipper swore out a complaint against Larry Sullivan for boarding his ship without permission. Larry was found guilty and fined $200. But when it came time for that skipper to sail out of port, he found his entire crew was staying at Larry's place, and the price for replacement sailors was $117 a head. Larry more than made up his $200 fee. Another skipper sent one of his officers on a coastwise steamer to San Francisco to hire a crew down there. Larry got wind and sent a runner down after him, probably on a train. The runner slipped aboard the steamer and almost managed to convince the entire freshly recruited crew to desert en route. When this didn't happen, Larry had the captain arrested on a specious kidnapping charge, delaying sailing for weeks. By the time the frustrated captain finally got underway, he had paid considerably more for his crew than he would have by simply swallowing his pride and paying Larry's rate. An agent for the U.S. Department of Justice tried to help solve the problem by building a case against Larry. He found to his dismay that all five of the ship captains he'd lined up weren't willing to stick around Portland for the months it would take to litigate. This was a slick operation, and it generated a chorus of howls of international protest from the British and French and German embassies. You will find plenty of historians who blithely assume those protests were at the shameful treatment of sailors in Portland and the dangers of Shanghaiing on its waterfront streets, but this is frankly naive. Those embassies didn't care about the sailors, and they didn't care about Shanghaiing in some podunk port on the other side of the world either. They cared about their ship captains, who considered themselves to be robbed because they were having to pay their sailors the money that they were supposed to pay their sailors instead of pocketing it. But in spite of all the wailing and gnashing of teeth, the Portland system didn't come to an end until 1904, when Larry Sullivan quit. Larry quit almost certainly because a new crusading and reforming spirit was in the air. The Lewis and Clark Exposition was slated for the following year, and Portlanders were a little concerned about the fact that the roughest and most unseemly part of Portland was clustered around the railroad depot. Incoming visitors would see drunks vomiting in the gutter and crooked gamblers at work in faro banks. They'd see prostitutes leaning out of little windows and cushions and cooing at them. There'd be ruffians punching each other. Who knows what else? Plus, steamships were increasingly taking over Portland's ship traffic, and steamships didn't need crimps. The crew quarters were much nicer, the work was far less demanding, and crew members liked working on them. Nobody was going to desert from a steamer berth at the behest of a boarding house runner, and if one ever did, the steamer skipper would have no difficulty filling the position. Correctly, Larry figured out that the good times were over for good. He left for Goldfield, Nevada, where he got together with a swindler named George Graham Rice to set up one of the most audacious and successful gold mining swindles in the history of the West. When that collapsed, he eventually wandered back to Portland, and he died here in Portland in 1918, just 55 years old. He lived fast and he kind of died young, didn't he? But in the years he was here, he changed Portland in some very colorful ways. Well, that's our show for today. This show is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. In addition to this podcast, it includes a weekly newspaper column, a daily RSS feed to catch on your smartphone reader, a Facebook page, a Twitter feed, and a couple other minor components, all accessible through our anchor page at offbeatoregon.com. Photographs and other images that go with today's show are also on offbeatoregon.com, along with full citations to the sources for this story. And while you're there, you can browse through more than 200 other articles written over the last 5 years, all organized by the date of publication. The podcast is covered under a Creative Commons license. For details, see offbeatoregon.com/cc. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band, atlasstringband.com, and it was written by Carmen Ficarra. I do this for learning and for fun, so I don't sell advertising and I don't ask for donations, but if you feel a need to make a donation, may I suggest you buy a copy of my book instead? It's called Wicked Portland, The Wild and Lusty Underworld of a Frontier Seaport Town, published by the History Press in 2012. You can order a signed copy if you like from the store link at offbeatoregon.com, but if you still have a local community bookstore in your town, I hope you'll consider buying it from them instead. It sells for $20. Finally, if you're ever in Corvallis, do drop me a line. Maybe we can grab a cup of coffee and talk history. I'm at finn@offbeatoregon.com. Don't be a stranger. Our next show will be coming your way at around 6 a.m. Monday morning. And until then, go fill up the rest of today and the weekend with good stuff. Bye now.